Give you the microphone from Michael Fernandez.
Can you hear me, Michael? How is it? Yeah, okay. Well, I guess I'll get started then. As I go on in a few seconds, let me know if the volume is working. And so I'll hold the microphone up to my mouth and do it. Okay, if you can hear me fine. Okay, if Richard can hear me fine, I'll start then. We're like a half hour overtime. Okay, if something happens and you can't hear me, write in the chat, so I'll stop. Okay. Okay, so let me know, and I'll stop. You can't hear me. So the road is first. Welcome, everyone, to the class, first of all. And one of the things about this famous book, The Road to Serfdom, is you can learn a great deal about Austrian economics by reading it. Hayek has developed a lot of his ideas, of course, by the 1940s. And a lot of these ideas, his economic ideas, are all through The Road to Serfdom. We're still working on the audio, it looks like. And so in the course of the next 5 weeks, you should learn a lot about Austrian economics, classical liberalism, some history, and, of course, the whole Hayekian system, the whole system that Hayek is known for of analyzing markets and government. Okay, Dan S. doesn't hear anything. It's very annoying. So I'll keep going. Let me know if I should stop if you can't hear me. I'm reading all the chats here. I guess it's all over the place. Some people say it's fine. Other people say no. Goodness. Okay, John says fine. Okay. One of the telling comments that Hayek makes in the first chapter is he's talking about World War II. Keep in mind, he wrote this book during 1943, and in the middle of the war. And I personally heard Hayek at Cambridge University in 1984 claim that he wrote most of the book sitting on the roof of a building in Cambridge University during the war, looking out for Nazi bombers. He was a jokester, and so that was probably a story that he was telling. But that's the context, and he says there that the war was a consequence of a struggle of ideas. Okay, struggle of ideas. And what were the ideas? Of course, he starts out with references to classical liberalism, which is why I put the famous book by Mises, Liberalism, a few chapters of it anyway, on the reading list. And so I think it's worth talking about that, because this is what the topic of the abandoned road, that's the road that was abandoned. He's talking about the development of the ideas of classical liberalism that had occurred over many generations, and it's all gone. Now I keep reading this, the audio is gone from Burwell Bell. Goodness. Can the rest of you hear me? Is it just Burwell? Okay, you can hear me just fine. I'm going to continue. Okay, and so what are these ideas? Well, first of all, the ideas of classical liberalism always have to start with private property, the ownership of private property. And why is that important? Well, with the development of institutions that protected and enforced private property rights, the whole world transformed itself into a situation of where a person could make use of his own private property, including his or her own body, to prosper, to make money, and to make money in business, for example, and by serving other people. And the only other alternative, really, is to be a servant to the state or to be involved in what the modern economists would be called rent-taking or sort of lobbying, politicking for benefits from the state. And so, part of the big importance of property rights, private property, was it created a sphere of independence of normal people, that they could prosper without being controlled by the state or being having the state as their benefactor and so forth. And so it led to individual freedom. It led to entrepreneurship. When people had private property, they learned that all of a sudden there was a very powerful incentive to improve your skills in working and whatever. To serve other people in order to make money, because you get to keep the money that you make. You're not just a servant, you're not a bureaucrat, or servant of the state anymore. And so property is essential for individual freedom and for freedom from coercion by the state. And that, of course, is why the socialists of all stripes have always attacked private property. It's why in the Communist Manifesto, it's written in big all-capital big black letters, abolition of private property was the primary focus of the Communist Manifesto. Jacob. Okay. Struggle of ideas. Private property, the principal idea of classical liberalism, is very important. Freedom is also very important, of course. So let's talk about negative versus positive freedom. The type of freedom that classical liberals like von Mises and Hayek talk about is it's called negative freedom because it's freedom from control by others, in particular control by the state. And that was always the understanding of freedom to the European classical liberals. And I get all kind of messages. And that was transformed. Ron Hayek is talking in this first chapter about how that was all transformed to the acceptance more and more of an idea of positive freedom, which means essentially freedom, more freedom for one person at the expense of freedom taken away from another person by the state. And so when you get up to the 1930s and 40s, when Hayek was working on the road to serfdom, you can look at Franklin Roosevelt's New Freedom, for example, where he talks about the freedom from not having enough housing, for example. So the case was made for the government to be involved in taxing one group of citizens and thereby reducing their freedom and stealing their income in order to benefit another group of citizens and thereby enhancing their freedom. Okay. And so this whole idea of that we should be free from control by government was transformed into greater and greater acceptance of what is called positive freedom. And Hayek mentioned this very prominently at the very beginning. And so keep letting me know. Let me know if the volume fades out. Peace is the other third element of classical liberalism, or the abandoned road. Of course, Hayek is writing this in the middle of World War II. Okay. And so, and of course, why is that important? Well, we have a large literature on this. I taught an online course on the political economy of war, and it was a 10-week course. So there's a very large literature, classical liberals especially, have been writing about war and peace for a long, long time. And just among some of the reasons why it's important to discuss peace is that, of course, war is the mother of the state. And the state is the main vehicle through which we lose our rights. And once the state goes past what Hayek would call the minimal state, which it always does very quickly, the state is basically involved in abrogating our property rights, not protecting our property rights, once it gets behind those minimal functions of maintaining law and order and a few other things. And so, of course, I'm referring to there's a famous essay by Randolph Bourne, B-O-U-R-N-E, War is the Health of the State, and I'll encourage anybody who's interested to read it, War is the Health of the State. And, of course, another one of our friends, Robert Higgs, is famous for his book Crisis of Leviathan, which explains what's called the ratchet effect of government that is created by war. Whenever any war occurs, now what am I, excuse me, I got another message. Go to the volume. The volume is turned up all the way that it can be turned up. Okay. I assume I can continue. I'm still reading these messages. Yeah. Okay. Well, what the ratchet effect is during something such as a war, the government always ratchets up its powers. It increases taxes. It nationalizes industries. It conscripts soldiers. And it abolishes many of our civil liberties. And so if you were to look at the growth path of government, you know, imagine a line that has a modest upward slope just because of the normal political forces that create the growth of government. And then all of a sudden there's a very big discrete jump up during wartime. And when the war is over, the government never gives up all of those powers that it took from us. Everyone's having trouble. I don't understand it, but I'll keep reading. And so the government never gives up all the powers that it has, so that when the war is over, the government ends up on a distinctly higher growth path, and our freedom is thereby diminished. And so that's another reason why classical liberals have always focused on peace. Okay. This is all over the lot. The message is okay. I can hear. I can't hear. I'm going to keep on going. Another reason why Hayek is warning, and Mises warns about of being especially vigorous in promoting peace, is their understanding, especially on the part of Mises, that socialists have always used war planning as an excuse to adopt a planned economy during peacetime. Okay? And so, and this is exactly what happened during World War I in the U.S. Murray Rothbard has several essays on the progressive era that you can look up on Mises.org about this, about how almost all of the so-called progressives of the early 20th century were in favor of World War I, even though none of them participated in the military in World War I. And basically the reason was, they thought it was a grand social experiment in central planning, and therefore when the war was over, they were intended to make the case or the argument that we planned our way to victory in the war, therefore we can plan our way to prosperity after the war. And so that's yet another reason why Hayek and Mises give warnings about being extra vigilant in guarding for peace and opposing war, especially non-defensive wars. Okay, and another point I would make about this is that war is essentially the exact opposite of capitalism. And capitalism essentially means the international division of labor, specialization of all the millions of human beings on the earth. We all specialize in one thing, we all have different skills, levels of intelligence, strength, physical strength, interests, ambitions, and we all focus on something. We all specialize on something. And so, and then we make money doing that one thing, and then we use that money to buy goods and services from other people who specialize in other things. And when we do that, we engage in peaceful, voluntary trade. War is exactly the opposite of that. As von Mises wrote in one of his writings, war bursts the thunder, the international division of labor. And so that's why such people as Thomas Jefferson, for example, there's a famous episode of where when he was president, the British were confiscating American soldiers and ships. And rather than risk another war with Great Britain, he imposed a trade embargo. And, of course, he was a free trader in theory and in his speeches, but he made a second worst choice. He decided that a war would be far, far worse, war with England, than a trade embargo, as bad and as awful as a trade embargo was. And Jefferson, of course, was well steeped in the classical liberal traditions, at least up to his time, that existed, and his understanding of how war is destructive of not only human beings and government treasuries, but freedom in general in so many ways. And so that's why classical liberals always were so much concerned with guarding peace an opposing war at all costs. And of course, when Hayek is writing there with the serfdom, the whole world was at war, and the whole ideology of fascism in all its varieties was warlike. These were the early neoconservatives, you could say, I suppose. Equality under the law is another one of the part of the road abandoned, as Hayek says. The classical liberals always advocated equality under the law, meaning essentially any system of law we have applies equally to everyone, even the President of the United States or the King or any other ruler, no exceptions. And it's very different from material equality, of course. And as we get into the book, you'll see why this is an important point, because when you have a system of any kind of system of socialism, it inevitably ends up as the government passing all kinds of laws and regulations that it thinks will help improve the economy, or so it says it thinks will improve the economy, but the inevitable consequence is that all these new laws and regulations will benefit some and harm others. So these laws won't be treating everyone equally. They'll be dispensing certain benefits to certain people, public employees especially. They always seem to win out with activist government at the expense of other people. And so Hayek will make the argument later in the book that any kind of government planning is inherently incompatible with the notion of equality under the law. And, of course, he was seeing this in spades during his time with the Soviet Union and fascism and all the rest of that's of interventionism. On the other hand, classical liberalism champions and defends inequality of wealth and income. And the reason it does that is that it is a natural consequence of the inequality of human beings. And as I said, you know, we're all different in terms of our mental abilities, our interests, our ambitions, our work habits, our physical strength, and a thousand other things. Human beings are all unique, all different. We're not all the same. We're not all bricks. We're all more like stones, and of course each stone is different and individual. I'm paraphrasing my friend Daniel Lapin, the rabbi who studies economics, and so in making the stone versus brick comparison. And as a result of that, we get the division of labor. Murray Rothbard had a wonderful essay on this called Egalitarianism as a Revolt Against Nature, a very clear explanation of this particular point. Okay, so the classical liberalism always defended inequality of income because it's a natural consequence of inequality of human beings. We're all different. You know, whether you call it inequality or just different, we're all different. And, of course, we know that the government attempts to force material equality have all led to disaster all around the world. And the next point, the role of the state. Well, Hayek certainly was no anarcho-capitalist, and neither was Mises, for that matter. But I tell people that, you know, had they lived, you know, Mises died first. He died in 1973, and Hayek was around much longer. But who knows, they might have come around and become more, a little more radical in their views as they saw the increasing futility of the idea of using a constitution to limit the government. That, of course, is where we are in the U.S. today, where there really are no limits on governmental power imposed by the constitution. Okay. I'll ask just one more time, I guess, about the volume. I guess we're getting along, so that I don't see a lot of complaints on the screen out there. So the role of the state, Hayek was a limited government libertarian, a constitutionalist. He had high praise for the U.S. Constitution, as did such people as Friedrich Bastiat, and so was Mises. Hayek was a little more enthusiastic about interventionism. If you read these chapters on the syllabus, you'll see that he advocates such things, various kinds of government regulation. He talks about government control of the money supply and control of monopolies being a desirable thing for the government to do. Mises was more suspect of all of that, to be sure, although Hayek did change. He did become more suspect and more critical of monetary policy later, after he wrote The Road to Serfdom. One of his famous books is called The Denationalization of Money, in fact. And so, Hayek, like all of us, changed his mind on things. He continued to educate himself. So when you read The Road to Serfdom, keep in mind that some of the ideas Hayek expresses here were extraordinarily radical libertarian ideas for his day, because everyone else in academia was a socialist, essentially, with a few exceptions, like the Austrians and a few people at the Chicago School. And so keep that in mind. He did change. Also, tolerance is a big part of classical liberalism. And there's one line in The Road to Serfdom where Hayek says this. He says, liberalism must be intolerant of every kind of intolerance. Now, why is that? Peace. We must not allow intolerance. We must not allow mobs to shut down free speech. We must not allow government officials, especially, to interfere with ideas that they do not approve of by shutting them down or censoring them. We must be intolerant of that. We must be tolerant of all religions, not because we're religious necessarily, but Hayek says, but because of the point that we don't want war to break out between the advocates of one religion and the other religion. We must be tolerant of all religions, he says, and that's the example that he gives. And so that's, Amici says that, rather, not Hayek. But Hayek does mention tolerance also, and he certainly is referring to the same idea that Amici expressed about this. And probably the biggest idea, economic idea, in the conception of the Road to Serfdom, is the idea of spontaneous order of markets. Hayek discusses this, but not in tremendous detail, which is why I put his famous article, The Use of Knowledge in Society, on the syllabus. And that is Hayek's classic statement of use of knowledge in society. And the idea of spontaneous order of markets, what he's saying here is that this is the idea that was developed by Adam Smith is given credit for being one of the first in developing the idea of the invisible hand, but there were writers before him who understood this, who understood that the economic incentives in the marketplace were such that individuals, if they're allowed to prosper through their own work, their own risk-taking, their own entrepreneurship, will see through it that we get our meat and our bread and our milk and everything else to us, and as though there was an invisible hand guiding all of them. Although there's nothing invisible or magical about it, of course, it's just the pursuit of rational self-interest by all human beings to make a living, and they work together cooperatively with other human beings to sell us meat and bread and everything else that we use in our everyday lives, and there's nothing magical or mystical about it. And another important point of this, in addition to the role of self-interest being benevolent, is explained in another famous essay that some of you no doubt have read. It's called I, Pencil by Leonard Reed. And Leonard Reed was the founder of the Foundation for Economic Education in New York. And in his famous essay, I, Pencil, Hayek doesn't cite it, but he's referring to the idea here, the same idea here of I, Pencil. It's a very cute essay written in the language of a pencil talking to you, and the pencil is explaining to you all of the different ingredients of the pencil, and explains why no one human being or no 50 human beings even could possibly make a pencil. When I explain this to an undergraduate student, I use pizza as an example instead of pencils. I ask them what their favorite pizza is. You list all the ingredients of a pizza, but if you think of just one ingredient of a pizza, wheat, I tell them that this class could not possibly produce a pizza. It would be impossible. Just one ingredient, the dough for the pizza. You would need a wheat farm to begin with. You would need all the equipment that goes into producing wheat at a wheat farm, all the fertilizers and everything else, the farm labor, all the expertise, all the engineering that goes into engineering the tractors and the other machinery and so forth. And that's just the one ingredient. That's just the dough to make the pizza, let alone the tomatoes and everything else. And so in reality, to make a simple thing like pizza, you need thousands of people all over the world collaborating and specializing, becoming experts in all the very fine details of wheat farming and tomato growing and everything else that goes into making a pizza, you know, turning the wheat into flour and flour into dough and so forth. And so to enjoy the very basic things in life that we all enjoy really does require the cooperation of thousands of people from all over the world, usually, to provide basic things like pizza and pencils. And so, and that's essentially what the spontaneous order of markets is all about. And what Hayek is saying in The Road to Serfdom is that the world, his world, essentially forgot that very important lesson and started living under the pretense that a few smart people at the top of the government could somehow do better than the efforts of many thousands or millions of human beings all over the world. That's why later in his career, when Hayek won the Nobel Prize, the title of his speech when he accepted the Nobel Prize is The Pretense of Knowledge. And it's published in the American Economic Review, by the way, I think around 1975 or 76, because he won the 74 Nobel Prize. And so The Pretense of Knowledge, of course, is a pretense that a small group of central planners and politicians could possibly have and utilize the knowledge of millions that we do rely on every day for the most basic fundamental things. Another important point here related to this is that the more complex a society becomes, the bigger it becomes, the more people it has, the more important it is to rely on markets, because the more unthinkable it is that small group of central planners can handle the additional informational requirements of a more complex, more larger society. And so, and Hayek does make that point in passing, but in reading The Road to Serfdom, you could easily miss that point because there's so much packed into this book. So that's essentially what he's talking about with spontaneous order. And of course, he does dwell on the role of property rights and markets and the impossibility of socialism. Later on in the book, we'll get into a lot more detail on the impossibility of socialism. But of course, the fatal flaw, there are a lot of reasons for the fatal flaws of socialism, but the basic Nietzschean argument has to do with economic calculation, and the train of logic goes like this. Property rights are required for markets because markets are all about trading property rights. When we buy and sell things, we are exchanging rights to own and use the things that we're trading. Property titles, when you talk about trading cars or houses or something like that. So you must have property rights, private property, to have real markets. And when you have real markets, we can calculate. We can have reasonable understanding of the real prices of the things that will cost us if we're in business, the inputs that go into producing goods and services. Otherwise, if the government just dictates prices, it's all arbitrary, and we have no way of knowing the meaning of those prices. But in the economic world, what prices tell us is they tell us all about fluctuations in both consumer demand, the demand side of the market, and supply side of the market. So when something is becoming more scarce in supply, its price will go up. And if the price will go up, people will start using less of it, and other people will start investigating ways to find more of it, to produce more of it, because they can make more money selling it, and people will search for alternatives or substitutes for that thing. And so prices in the marketplace are our guide as to what to use, what to buy, whether we should conserve or not conserve, how to organize the production of goods and services in the most efficient way. And you can't have that information that we need to calculate profit and loss, for example, in the marketplace, unless we have market prices based on a private property society. And of course, the whole idea of socialism was the idea of the abolition of private property. And so the socialists played at markets for a while. Some of them did. But it was never had a chance of working. And another reason why socialism never could work was Hayek's famous knowledge problem, which I just really explained. And so we have the calculation problem of that without prices, you have no rational way of knowing such things as whether things are in increased or decreased supply. So that's what is reflected in higher and lower prices. And so that's the calculation problem in a nutshell. And then there's the knowledge problem, the idea of how to utilize the knowledge of society in producing goods and services. Decentralized knowledge is the Hayekian message in the Road to Serfdom. And in everything else he wrote, we have to rely on the what was called the information of time and place, the information that we all have about how we do our job, however minuscule and minute that information might be in the grand scheme of things. And that's, there's no way that politicians or central planners could ever possess or imitate that information. And that's the famous Hayekian knowledge problem. And as an aside, Wikipedia, the founder of Wikipedia, if you look him up on the web, he'll say that the story of how he got the idea for Wikipedia is that he was a student at Auburn University, and he walked over to the Mises Institute and met my friend Mark Thornton. And Mark Thornton gave him a copy of The Use of Knowledge in Society. He was interested in Austrian economics. He was studying finance and computers at Auburn. And his reading of The Use of Knowledge in Society and his discussion of the importance of decentralized knowledge is where the idea for Wikipedia came from. And, of course, it is a grand example of decentralized knowledge rather than having one really smart guy or gal or one committee dictate down to us what we should know. Okay, and that's how Wikipedia was born. One other element of liberal economic policy that's worth mentioning at this point is bureaucratization. And one of the points Mises always made about bureaucratization is that the more bureaucratized, that is government bureaucratized, a society becomes, the more that businesses have to spend their time, effort, and money catering to the whims of the bureaucrats who regulate and control their businesses at the expense of catering to the whims of their customers. So every hour that a business manager spends dealing with a government bureaucrat, filling out paperwork, responding to questions by the government, is an hour that he or she cannot spend figuring out how to produce better prices, better products at lower prices. And so it's the opportunity cost, if you will, of capitalism foregone, is the opportunity cost, real capitalism foregone, whenever we become a more and more bureaucratized society. And so, and we'll talk much more about this later in the class, but that's another element of liberal or classical liberal economic policy I wanted to mention. As far as individualism is concerned, this is probably nothing that has been more perverted or misstated than what individualism is all about. As Hayek says in the first chapter, the basis of individualism, as understood by the classical liberals, was always essentially respect for the individual as an individual. And the defense of life, liberty, and property of the individual. If there is to be a role for the state, for example, Hayek would say the one legitimate role of the state is the protection of life, liberty, and property. And that's it. And Mises was of the same opinion. And so that's all individualism has ever meant. It has never meant that it would be desirable to have isolated human beings who are not in contact with one another. That's just a foolish straw man argument, because after all, the whole edifice of libertarian or classical liberal economic theory, beginning before Adam Smith, is all about the cooperation of individuals to produce goods and services for their fellow man, and so that they can prosper in doing so. And so we've always recognized that individualism does not mean isolated individuals acting alone. But that's a straw man argument that has often been brought up to try to discredit freedom and to advocate some sort of tyranny through government. Okay, and so understand what that he's meaning when he talks about the word individualism. There's a great quote that I want to bring up here in a second. I'm going to grab a book here. sound okay? Sorry about this again. Okay. I'll read the quote again then, some of you that haven't heard it. Just a minute. No. Okay, okay. This is Ludwig von Mises, so I'll reread the quote. Private property creates for the individual a sphere in which he is free of the state. It sets limits to the operation of the authoritarian will. It allows other forces to arise side by side with and in opposition to political power. It thus becomes the basis of all those activities that are free from violent interference on the part of the state. It is the soil on which the seeds of freedom are nurtured, and in which the autonomy of the individual and ultimately all intellectual and material progress are rooted. And so that's a great statement of the link, the important link between property and freedom. And I was also saying it's also why Hans Popper, the Austrian school economist, 6 years ago founded something called the Property and Freedom Society. It's an intellectual society based on those of us who believe on property and freedom are important, and we need to preserve them and the ideas about them. Okay, so that's, I assume everyone heard that. That's a von Mises quote, right? Moving on to what Hayek calls the Great Utopia. He first makes the point that, socialists of all kinds have always attacked freedom, and he mentions, there are a few quotations in the book about how, some socialists threatening to treat people like cattle if they don't obey his preferred orders or dictates, and of course that has always been true of socialists who are willing to treat people like that. And so, in Hayek's day, he was attacking and criticizing fascism and, of course, communism. But in World War II, the communists were American allies in World War II. And so I put a few articles on the list of syllabus by Mussolini, one on Mussolini, to hear from the horse's mouth what fascism was. And all throughout the Road to Serfdom, Hayek repeats the point that the fascist theorists all were socialists in the beginning. Mussolini himself was a PhD and a writer, and he was a socialist for much of his life, and that fascism was just a variety of socialism, which is essentially true. Sort of socialism on the cheap. At the beginning, socialism meant the government ownership of the means of production. And it eventually changed with the fascists who decided, well, it's too cumbersome and maybe too costly to actually take over businesses. And besides, what do we know about running these businesses, we the socialists? And so they allowed private property, but it became very, very strictly controlled and regimented and regulated by the state, and it had to only perform those duties that it was given by the state, supposedly for the public interest. The 5-point program of the Nazi Party is a famous document where the Nazi Party itself declares this is what we believe in, and is that it says the Nazis said everything we want to do is based on this philosophy, and in the German it comes out as saying common good before individual good. So fascism was an attack on individualism and classical liberalism first and foremost. If you read the Mussolini essay on the syllabus, about 7 or 10 paragraphs down, He directly confronts individualism and trashes and demeans the notion of individualism and freedom, because after all, he was a fascist and a socialist. And that's what a socialist of all varieties have always done. And so, the common good, of course, as defined by who? As defined by, Mussolini himself, of course, or Hitler or somebody else, or whoever the government is. It's never us, it's never the people. it's always the rulers who will define what is the common good, and they usually mean making at least some of us slaves to them, either by being taxpayers or conscripts in their armies, or both, or some other means. And so that's the collectivist philosophy right there, in a nutshell. Common good before the individual good. Ayn Rand put it nicely once in one of her writings where she remarked that under this philosophy, it's not desirable for a young person to get an education, to get married, have a family, start a business. That's not good itself. What's good, though, is to be a sacrificial lamb for the state. That's what a young person should think about doing. And, of course, Ayn Rand was criticizing collectivism in all forms. And in The Road to Serfdom, Hayek says that socialism and fascism are just varieties of collectivism, but it all means the same thing. It's all essentially the same thing. Perspective is private property was allowed, but it was very heavily regimented and regulated for government purposes. And in other words, the consumer was out of the picture. As Mises wrote in many of his publications, Human Action and elsewhere, on the outside, capitalism looks like the bankers and the corporate executives really run the show and make all the decisions. But he also explained in tremendous detail in his writing that it is ultimately in a capitalist system the consumer who is in control. They can bankrupt you tomorrow if they drop your product, no matter how big and rich and powerful you are. If someone else comes up with a significantly better product than yours, you better follow through and come up with something even better, or you may be out of business. So consumer sovereignty was a big part of von Mises' discussion of capitalism, and that was thrown out the window with fascism and with socialism, and replaced by the whims of politicians and bureaucrats, and pretty much the heck with consumer sovereignty. Okay. Another important element of fascism was bailouts. I've written about this 20 years ago. I was writing articles on economic fascism. And of course, the fascists in Europe in the 20s and 30s, they took control essentially of all these industries. They allowed private ownership, but they controlled what was going on. And of course, when all these industries failed to make any money and had huge deficits, the fascists, like all socialists, whether it's Joseph Stalin or the mayor of Washington, D.C. today, who runs or any city today that runs essentially a socialist or socialistic enterprise, they don't want to admit that they're failing, that they have a huge deficit and that their government-run subway system or their government-run bus system is hemorrhaging money and costing the taxpayers a bundle. And so they'll subsidize. They'll find some way to find government money, taxpayer money, to subsidize the losses and the failures. And that was very pervasive in fascism in Europe in the 1920s and 30s. So that's another element of it. And of course, it's very pervasive today in the U.S., the bailout of all the big banks and others. Hayek makes a passing comment here that socialism and freedom cannot be combined. They're inherently incompatible, like oil and water. And essentially, he gets into this in great detail later. He's just introducing this idea in the first chapter or two. But what it essentially means is that so-called democratic socialism is really an oxymoron. You can't have real democracy and socialism. And socialism essentially involves the use of coercion to impose one sort of unitary plan on a whole society. That's what socialism is. That's what it's all about. And you cannot allow dissenters. You cannot allow people to take a vote and say, no thanks, we don't want socialism. And so, and Hayek explains this in much more detail in a later chapter, but since he does bring it up in chapter 2, I thought I would mention. A big myth that many of you probably, or maybe all of you, have heard of before, that they've heard of a socialist credo that it would be desirable if businesses would produce goods and services for use and not for profit. And of course, the reason why that's ridiculous is that no successful business can be successful unless their product is useful to consumers. You can't make a profit unless you produce things that are useful, so useful to consumers that they will voluntarily give you money in return for your product or your service. And so this whole idea, this whole chant or slogan of production for use and not profit is wrong-headed nonsense from beginning to start. But you still hear it today. You heard it in Hayek's time. And that's what he does bring it up. Another big point that Hayek makes in many of his writings, not just The Road to Serfdom, is that in all the talk about government planning of his day and the desirability of government planning, that the presumption was that the economic world is sort of chaotic and random, but of course it's not. We all plan every day. You know, individuals plan. Business people plan how to run their businesses. School children plan their school day. They get older, they plan their educational careers. They plan their careers and their jobs. Families plan. Well, everybody plans. And so the big question is, who is to do the planning? Are we to have a society of free individuals where the government remains the enforcer of law and order and the enforcer of contracts and the defender against foreign invaders? Or do we have a society of where we have a street dance where the government can take over and do all our planning for us? And so Hayek takes this on in an early chapter, although in later chapters, he goes into much greater detail on planning and his critiques of government planning. But he just introduces it here in this early chapter. And in one way that he puts his take on what government should be doing, I forget what page it's on, but he talks about government having one role as, say, providing road signs to tell us where to go. He says that would be okay. So socialist roads, if you will, they're okay as long as we have road signs, we know where to go. But that's different, he says, from telling us where to go. Rather, ordering us to go here, he's thinking of a more limited role of government would be putting up road signs and help us go where we want to go. And so that's how he puts it. I see a question from Alexander. We'll have a Q&A at the end there. So yes, democracy is a form of collectivism. I guess I can answer that now. And so Bastiat made a great point in his essay, The Law, that you can get the same thing under democracy as you can get under socialism. If the legislature votes to have one uniform policy for everybody, well, that's what socialism does. And just because we take a vote on it doesn't mean we can't. It's not essentially the same as socialism. It's a collectivist thing. Okay? And as I said earlier, Hayek does go along with all kinds of interventionism. On page 43, for example, he proposes government intervention for money, markets, and channels of information. For example, he might have softened up in his old age on this, but he comes right out. He also makes the case for public goods, for the government to provide so-called public goods, where the story goes a voluntary society would not provide adequate amounts of such things as national defense, if you can call that a public good. At the local level of government, the economics textbooks often use something like mosquito abatement as a public good. If I benefit from less disease being spread by mosquitoes, it does not mean that you do not also benefit. That's only one of the attributes of a public good. So that's the type of thing that economists have long held would not be financed privately. But again, Hayek may have changed his mind and softened up on this in later years, because there were a lot of studies done after that, after he wrote The Road to Serfdom, showing that, yes, this might be true that you have a lot of these goods with these attributes of clean air. If I breathe clean air, it does not mean you do not. Whereas with a private good, if I drink a Coca-Cola, you do not drink that same can of Coca-Cola. It's a private good. But human beings have had all sorts of ingenious ways of dealing with these problems apart from government. One of the most famous examples that's cited in the economics is the lighthouse. The economist Ronald Coase wrote a famous article called The Lighthouse in Economics, where economists for decades argued that the light from a lighthouse is a public good, and so therefore governments need to intervene and pay for them. And Coase found that for many generations in England, merchants were not so stupid as to be in the business of transporting millions of pounds worth of goods by ship in the dark, in the fog, and risking the high risk of having it crash on the rocks. And even if they were insured, well, then their insurance rates would go up when they could solve the problem by privately financing lights and lighthouses. And so, and this was quite an important article some years ago in the Journal of Modern Economics by Ronald Coase. And so Hayek may have changed his mind that he lived a little longer and more professionally active, and understood that there is a very big literature on private solutions, voluntary solutions to these so-called free rider problems that they're called. If you give people enough time, they'll do a much better job than government bureaucrats at solving these problems. I know we've got a late start, so lots of the chaos over the volume, but those are the points I wanted to make about these first few chapters for now, and I think I did about 45 minutes or so, I guess, at least here, and so I think what I'll do now is read over, and if you have any questions, I guess, since I didn't print out any questions that you had earlier, I'm afraid. But I'll read over the chat, and if you have some questions, I'll sit here and answer them. The Mises Institute publishes a very nice volume, and I wrote the foreword to it also. So please go ahead and type in questions. In all the turmoil, I didn't have time to print out your questions, I'm afraid. On collectivism and socialism, Hayek says that socialism is just a variety of collectivism, as is fascism. So they're essentially the same thing. He says all the attributes of collectivism that he writes about, they all go for socialism. Well, democracy, of course, has this. How's it sound now? Lost audio? It's back. Well, democracy has different problems from socialism, of course. Audio is back. I'd recommend the book Democracy, the God That Failed by Hans Hermann Hoppe. It's a real classic critique of democracy. Both Mises and Hayek spoke favorably of democracy. In the Road to Serfdom, in these chapters of the science of tonight, he quotes Tocqueville, I believe, in the readings for tonight, as equating democracy with freedom. That goes a little too far, because democracy, of course, as it is today, is the opposite of freedom. It's government is just one big grab bag of goodies for the politically connected at the expense of the taxpayers. And so the big problem with democracy, since I'm moving on this, I'll mention one big problem. One of Murray Rothbard's favorite political philosophers was John C. Calhoun. And it's one of the reasons for this was that Calhoun, who was Vice President of the United States, Secretary of War, at one point, he wrote a great book called A Disquisition on Government, which is online, and you can also buy it from Liberty Fund if you want a copy of it. But he carried forward the old classical liberal class theory. It was very different from the Marxian class theory. Marxian class theory, or class struggle theory, was supposedly a struggle between the capitalists and the workers. The classical liberal or libertarian class theory posits a struggle between what are called net taxpayers and net tax consumers. Net taxpayers are people who pay more in taxes than they get in any kind of benefit from government. Net tax consumers are people who get more from the government than they pay in taxes, public employees, welfare recipients, and so forth. And Calhoun, in his book published in 1850, forecast that a constitution would never be enough, never be adequate to avoid a situation where the tax consumers outnumber and outpower the taxpayers and pretty much gang up and plunder the taxpayers, the productive people of the country. And of course, that has all come true. This was not original with Calhoun. It actually goes back to the 1600s with the conquest theories of the state that existed at the time. But that is one of the reasons why Rothbard always wrote in many places that he considered Calhoun to be one of his favorite American political theorists, because he understood that. And that was the essential problem of democracy by the classical liberal class theorists. And it's different than the problem of socialism with the pretense of knowledge and the belief that you can calculate profit and loss without markets. Those are the main criticisms of socialism. But democracy is legal thunder, as Bastiat called it, once it goes beyond the limits of just simply maintaining law and order and protecting us from aggressors and enforcing business contracts and so forth. And of course, that lasted only a very short period of time, even in the U.S. And those people who criticize anarcho-capitalism as being unrealistic, I would argue that one thing that history proves is clear as a bell is that the idea that the government can be limited by a constitution is a myth. We just haven't seen it. Let me see if I can have a question here. And immigration. Well, keep in mind, when Mises was writing this, there was a really no welfare state to think of. A lot of well-known economists were considered free market. And I'm thinking of people like Milton Friedman, Gary Becker, Walter Williams, Thomas Sowell, all have written in opposition to open borders immigration policy, because of the existence of a welfare state. And their argument is basically that when you have a large welfare state like the U.S. has, yes, we'll get plenty of people who come to the U.S., the immigrants who want to work, but we'll also get millions who get on welfare and become a drain to society. And so all of them were in favor of, these men that I mentioned were in favor of limits to immigration. And Mises might have been the same had he lived longer. And he probably wasn't very active at least the last 5 years of his life, maybe the last 10 years. So he wasn't, keep in mind, when Mises came to America in 1939, he was already 60 years old. And so his mind was probably pretty weary by 1970. to be sure. And so, but had he lived longer, he might have changed his mind on immigration, as far as that goes. And so, that's the difference between VCs of that era and some of these other more modern libertarian economists. People turn up knocking on the door. You can't see how it's infrastructure, if it's COVID, infrastructure of the country. I think someone like Tom Lasole will respond by saying that if Sowell once did a calculation that the entire population of the planet could be placed on 2,500 square foot homes on a quarter acre lot in the state of Texas. And so there would be room, I think, for immigration. It depends on infrastructure. I think you might be meaning healthcare, hospitals, schools, and so forth. Well, yeah, that creates huge problems in places where you have a flood of non-taxpayers, illegal immigrants, and putting burdens on these facilities. That's certainly true. To democracy take place, what was the main push? I think my view of the big breaking point was the Civil War, because if you look at the size of government before the Civil War, the average American paid about $45 a year in taxes to the federal government, and his or her only contact ever was through the post office. And that all changed. The Civil War was sort of a point of demarcation. And I'm not saying it's a sharp point where we went all of a sudden in one year from that. But, you know, war is the mother of the state. Regardless of what the cause of the war is or the purpose of the war, it's the mother of the state. The state always grows. That's when we adopted the first income tax. We nationalized the money supply with the National Currency Act and the Legal Tender Act during the American Civil War. The internal revenue bureaucracy was created during the war. Habeas corpus was suspended in the northern states during the duration of the war. Martial law. Newspapers were shut down, over 300 of them in the northern states. So government power, government tentacles reached into all areas of government. And the age-old story is that if a government succeeds at something, winning the war, by doing all these things, heavy taxation, military conscription, crushing of political dissenters, shutting down of opposition newspapers, maybe it'll work in peacetime, too. Maybe more government power is a good thing after all. And so, and I've written several books about this. The Real Lincoln was one, Lincoln Unmasked. And all, of course, my book on Hamilton covers this guy, too, Hamilton's Curse. Tell part of the same story, but I think that was a watershed that led to sort of the worshipping of democracy. By the time you get to the late 19th century, a good example would be the year 1913. The year 1913, we adopted the Fed, the income tax, and the 17th Amendment to the Constitution. And the 17th Amendment changed the American system of politics from one where senators, United States senators, were appointed by state legislatures to ones where they were popularly elected, because that's democratic, it's more democratic for the state. But the reason why in the original Constitution senators were appointed by state legislatures is that the founders knew that a politician could easily say one thing back home and make promises back home, and then go to the nation's capital and be captured by special interest groups. And vote in favor of the thing the special interest groups wanted, who would then finance his career, And sometimes those things will be at odds with the well-being of the people back home. And so the state legislators wanted to be able to fire United States senators on the spot if they did that. And they did on numerous occasions. There were 7 senators who, in the 1830s in the United States, claimed that they supported Andrew Jackson's opposition to the existence of the Bank of the United States, which was a precursor of the Fed. Andrew Jackson eventually vetoed the bill for the rechartering of this bank, the central bank, and it went out of existence. But there were 7 senators who went to Washington and switched and became enemies or opponents of Andrew Jackson on the bank issue, and all 7 of them were fired by the state legislature. But by the time you get to the turn of the 20th century, the worshiping of democracy had taken place. And so that enabled arguments to be made to have direct election of senators, and the exact thing that the founders were worried about has happened, that the senator from Illinois goes to New York City and Los Angeles to raise money for his or her campaign, because that's where the money is. It's not where the people of Illinois are, but it's where the money is to pay for television ads and your staff and, you know, the campaign. And so the Constitutional Republic was highly decentralized, and after the Civil War, the government became a highly centralized bureaucratic system. It really did not exist in any significant way before the Civil War, and it only grew and grew and grew. And of course, World War I really created a huge centralization of power, and that was really the death knell of the Constitutional Republic, in my view, 1913, and then the eventual entry of World War I, and the advent of the income tax. When the income tax came online, what that meant is the government declared that it owns all of your income, and it will decide for you how much you get to keep by announcing to you what the tax rate will be. If the tax rate is 1%, well, then that's good. But the government could also say it's going to be 90% because it has the right to do that. It gave itself the right to do that. And that's more like a constitutional dictatorship than the idea of a republic of the founders. Opponents of freedom. Well, sure. Anybody who wants to live at someone else's expense is an enemy of freedom. And if you form, that's the tax-consuming class. And we're in a bind in the U.S. as far as democracy now goes, because the tax system. Many of you have probably heard the statistic about how something like 50% of the population now, the working age population, does not pay income tax or pay a very minuscule amount of income tax. Therefore, they have very strong incentives to vote for higher taxes for the other 49% or so who do pay significant income tax. And so we're at the point now in the U.S. Of where John T. Calhoun's prediction is certainly coming true. The tax eaters and the tax consumers have finally outnumbered and outweighed the tax producers, or the taxpayers. And that's where we are today. Well, limited government, you know, that's true, it hasn't. That's one lesson we should know from history. Socialism is the road to serfdom, and it certainly is. It's also the road to mass murder and death by the hundreds of millions, according to 20th century history. Are we doomed to despotism? Well, no. Most people think horizontally when they think of government. They think of left and right, Democrats, Republicans, can we get our candidate in office who will do something to enforce the Constitution? We've been saying that. We've been trying that for generations, and it has utterly failed. But you can also think vertically, if you will, in terms of decentralizing power. And that's what nullification is all about. That's what secession is all about. It's all about secession and saying, I've had enough. I leave. I'm not going to participate anymore. There's a group of people in Vermont who have created something called Second Vermont Republic. If you go on their website, you can read all their literature. And they're very serious about wanting Vermont to succeed and become its own country again. Thomas Jefferson once predicted that there would be maybe 7 or 8 different republics. And he said, we would wish them all well. They would all be our children. I could paraphrase a letter that he wrote saying that. They would all be Americans, he said, and we'd wish them all well. And so the whole idea behind secession, or the threat of secession, was to impose a check on the tyrannical proclivities of the central government. And the same with nullification. The main person attached to the idea of nullifying federal laws is Thomas Jefferson. As soon as the big government people of George Washington's day, the Federalist Party, got a lot of power with the Adams administration, the second administration after George Washington, they passed the Sedition Act, which outlawed free political speech in America. And Jefferson is famous for having authored something called the Kentucky Resolve of 1798, which he was asked to write by a friend of his who was a senator, U.S. senator from Kentucky, John Breckinridge. And in it, it was a declaration that we, the people of Kentucky, do not intend to enforce the Sedition Act within our state. James Madison wrote the Virginia Resolve of 1798 and said the same thing. And this sort of thing had occurred before that, but this, but Jefferson and Madison are the names that are most closely associated with this idea of nullification of federal laws. Because it wasn't until the Civil War, again, that this idea that the Supreme Court is the final arbiter of all things constitutional. Prior to the Civil War, presidents often thumbed their noses at the Supreme Court. Andrew Jackson, when the Supreme Court ruled that the Bank of the United States was constitutional, he responded by simply saying, thank you for your opinion, but my opinion is different, and we have 3 branches of government, not 1, and my branch is just as legitimate and just as important as your branch, Mr. Chief Justice. And that was the thinking of a lot of Americans prior to the Civil War. In my book, Lincoln Unmasked, I quote Woodrow Wilson, who was a professor at Princeton before he became president, writing in his book on the Congress, as writing very approvingly of the fact that this happened, that after the Civil War, there was no more states' rights, there was no more the citizens of the states or presidents or anybody ruling on what's constitutional and what's not. From then on, the majority of the court, 5 government lawyers with lifetime tenure, were to announce to all of us what our freedom would be. And of course, the Jeffersonians thought this was absurd, and it was the definition of tyranny, which it is. So that's the system we've lived under since 1865 in America. And so if you think vertically rather than horizontally, you think of a path to freedom would be smaller government, less centralized power, secession, nullification. And if not, we are just destined to become more and more enslaved by the state. Just today, the big headline was the U.S. Treasury Secretary says we need to raise taxes. That'll help a lot, either side of the 10% unemployment problem in the U.S. K.L. Santos. Even in philosophical circles, they talk about positive and negative freedom or rights. There's one thing to say that you have a right to life, liberty, and property. It's totally different to say that you have a right to a house. So if you have a right to a house, that means someone else has the obligation to pay for the house. It's not you, someone else. And so that was never the understanding of the classical liberals. So, the meaning of rights certainly has changed. And so then, economically speaking, in Europe, well, I mean, they're broke, they're bankrupt. What road should these countries take? Well, of course, I think they should take the road to freedom, and as opposed to the road to servitude. You have a choice at some point, freedom versus servitude. But of course, especially in Europe, so many people are accustomed to being given things by the state. Especially young people seem to have been extraordinarily brainwashed, in Greece especially, where they're rioting and committing acts of violence over the threat that everything won't be taken care of for them at someone else's expense. That's an attitude that the state has inculcated in the population for generations, and it will be hard to get away from that. But the alternative is even more servitude. So I can't make any predictions of what the Europeans will do. The reason why we engage in educational enterprises like this is that so that at least some of us can understand the importance of choosing freedom over servitude and tyranny. All of these governments, the U.S. government, could easily become in much better financial shape by doing, one, selling off some of its assets. The U.S. government owns more than 50% of all the land west of the Mississippi River, for example, and privatizing many of the things that it does. A lot of what government does, there's never been any demand for it by anybody. There's no way of expressing demand for government like there is in the marketplace, where customers line up and pay their money for these things. A lot of what government does is not solving public goods problems, but just doing stuff that government thinks it might be doing, and it can employ a lot of people and spend a lot of money and have a career doing it, but if there's no consumer demand for it. And so, people need to wake up to this and say, if we want this thing, the private sector should do it. Put it out for competitive bid and privatize it. Let the private companies do it rather than the government. If you were to look at a list of everything state and local governments do in the U.S., there are private companies that do every single one of those things and invariably do it better and cheaper. And the government is just one big monopolistic organization in that regard. And we have to understand that, and that is a way out to resolve some of these problems that exist in financially. The only alternative is to become even bigger tax slaves and pay the government bureaucrats even higher salaries to give us non-services that they do just like they do now. Save European civilization? I don't think so. We're going to read Omnipotent Government or some chapter of Omnipotent Government a little later. So I don't think that's at all what Mises is saying. I'm reading this question here. That can't be anything Mises said. Nationalism under these fascist governments is really the target of Mises in his book Omnipotent Government. And by the way, I didn't mention that in my talk, but these two books were written a year apart. They were the take by Hayek and Mises on despotism and the tyranny of their age. And so these are the two of the most learned men in the world at the time, certainly the two most of the learned classical liberals of their day, writing on this very big topic.
Robert Yates, the author of the famous book Christ and Leviathan that I mentioned, he coined the phrase participatory fascism, and I think he coined it, as it described the American system of today. You know, fascism was a dictatorship, and we have democracy, and we let people vote. Bob once told me that he thought the only reason we have free speech in America is that the politicians know that it doesn't really matter, that what we say doesn't really matter, it doesn't affect them. They pretty much do what they want. They've all gerrymandered themselves in to permanent careers in Congress, for the most part. You know, very, very few incumbents ever get unseated. That's been true for at least 50 years now. And so so they don't care. They let us talk and talk and talk, and then they do what they want, as far as that goes. So, I think participatory fascism would be a good explanation. I have an article on the syllabus at some point that I wrote, I think it was on Mises.org a while back, on fascialism. I argue that the American economic system has really become a combination of fascism and socialism. You know, with the nationalization, you know, de facto nationalization of General Motors and much of the banking system by the Obama administration, and then the control, the extreme controls that the government has on other industries, well, that's fascism, essentially. So we have a combination of fascism and socialism, but some tiny pockets of capitalism here and there in the U.S. Didn't Jefferson's philosophy inherently foster a worshiping of democracy? Well, Jefferson's philosophy is a complicated thing. He was known as a strict constructionist on the Constitution, and so he warned about the dangers of democracy, unbridled democracy, as much as anybody. One of his famous slogans was, "The natural tendency of things is for government to gain ground and liberty to yield." That's why he opposed the central bank, and he opposed pretty much everything Hamilton wanted to do. Hamilton is the one who wanted unlimited democracy, you know, without hardly any constitutional constraints. He actually advocated a permanent president, a dictator, essentially. So Jefferson's political philosophy is is kind of a complicated thing. He also believed that the Tenth Amendment was the cornerstone of the U.S. Constitution, because Article 1, Section 8 only gave the federal government the power to do about 17 specific things, and some of these things are not very important, very big either, patents, things like that. They're not very, you know, momentous, you know, the post office, you know, creating coins but not paper money, things like that. But beyond that, everything else is left up to the citizens and the states under the 10th Amendment. And so Jefferson's ideal of democracy was a very, very decentralized and a very limited role for the central government. And the central government would be the agent of the state government. And of course, Jefferson was also the author of the American Declaration of Secession from the British Empire. The Declaration of Independence was a declaration of secession from the British Empire. And late in his life, he spoke favorably of secession in various letters he wrote on. If you go online to lewrockwell.com, find an article of mine called Happy Secession Day, about the 4th of July. I quote Jefferson from various letters as being in the 1820s, near the time, you know, close to when he died, as being in favor of that. And so it depends on how you define democracy. Constitutional democracy, where the people still have a right of secession, and of course, nullification. Jefferson is the one who authored the nullification, wasn't a law, but a statement. And the whole idea of nullification is solidly connected to Thomas Jefferson. And so that's a very different definition of democracy than the kind that sprang up after the Civil War, where states' rights, decentralized government, secession, and nullification were destroyed and became non-existent. Until today. There's talk of it today, but not much action. But so I wouldn't say that Jefferson's philosophy was
at all behind the runaway democracy. Totalitarianism, because people do revolt eventually. The Soviet Union got to be so bad that the people had had enough finally, and the Soviet Union ended. And so to say that we're moving down the road to tyranny is not to say that we will go all the way to the end of the road. At some point, there could be a revolt. The sheeple could wake up, or the bourgeoisie, as some of us call the masses. That happened. It has happened in other countries. It could happen here again at some time. Maybe it'll take the destruction of the dollar to wake people up to this. Who knows? But I think that's my reading of history. Sometimes things have to get sufficiently bad before you can move in a different direction. And there are swings in history, toward more. Certainly, fascism of the 1920s and 30s was a bad swing. And of course, we backed off on that to a very large extent, and now we're going back in the other direction. We've been at it for a good hour and a half, and I know not all of you have unlimited time. So I think we should probably call it a night. We all apologize for the technical difficulties, but we'll see you again the next session. I'll make sure I read the questions in advance, do the readings, and we'll have the best class that I can put together next time. And thanks to the staff for working very hard in solving those technical problems. They're always excellent, no matter what we throw at them. And have a good night.